Just so we're catching up, me yeah. and the listener here. What is a Discord server?
Do you know what Discord is?
So no. I know what Discord is. Yeah, oh. Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, featuring your hosts, Gabe Reinick and Ken Holyoke.
Welcome back to the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. I'm Gabe Reinick, and I am still in Connecticut. And the listener is going to be a little surprised about that I've been in Connecticut for what will seem like two fortnights. But actually, it's got to do with our recording schedule. It is still hot, listener, where I am, and it is still cold in Lethbridge, Alberta, where Ken is. How are
exactly.
you, Ken?
And yeah, I'm doing well. And Gabe, not only are you still in Connecticut, you are still in that bar in Connecticut, and you are wearing another tiki shirt. Like you are.
That's right.
It's I'm sure there's a Jimmy Buffett quote I could throw out here, but I really don't like Jimmy Buffett. So.
Yeah. I am living on sponge cake. Is that the phrase?
is that Jimmy Buffett line?
I'm not sure. Whatever it is, I've changed latitudes and changed attitudes, and that's the important part, isn't it?
Exactly.
And how are you this fortnight, Ken?
It's good. I'm doing well. In the last day, it has warmed up slightly, and we have some summery weather on the way. And actually, we're coming to you, listener, today on the summer solstice, the longest day of the year.
We are indeed coming to you on the summer solstice, and that means, Ken, that our sponsors have actually paid a little extra for this show because obviously solstice rates do apply, and those sponsors are the Association of Professional Archaeologists of New Brunswick and the ULET Shirk Exchange, and we really appreciate them. They help us to make this thing happen every fortnight, and they help to pay Emmanuel, which is increasingly a crucial part of this operation.
Of actually getting this out every fortnight.
That's right. But Ken, one of the other things that those sponsors would help with is that they've encouraged us, I think, because they would also, you know, like to see us moving more product, to try to come up with a name for this show that really conveys the scope of what we started to do on this program. And so, like, for instance, in the upcoming show, we're going to be talking to Emma about a number of different topics that aren't really about New Brunswick archaeology. And so to kind of capture this expanding scope, we think a name with a little more pizzazz, a little less regionally specific, all of these things would be nice. And we would never think of just stealing a name that the listener sent in. And so if a listener sends in a name, we want to make sure that they're properly compensated. And so, Ken, if the listener had a new name for this podcast, where would they send it?
They would send that name to newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. That's New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word, archaeology spelled archaeology, newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com.
That's right. And so, Ken, as you know, I'm a graduate of the University of Connecticut. Go Huskies. And UConn, near where I am right now, is the public land-grant university down here. But until the 1930s, it was an agricultural college, and it actually retains a pretty big agricultural presence. You know, chickens, farms, livestock, and it has its own creamery. In fact, UConn is so agricultural that my PhD supervisor was actually the head coach of the women's polo team, which, you know, really mixes horses and Connecticut. And anyway, since 1953, the agricultural portion of the university, and specifically the creamery, has been turning milk into some of the finest ice cream around. And it's funny how this happens, Ken, but I was in a pretty bright graduate cohort there at UConn, and I think by and large my intellectual ability was held in some disrepute by my colleagues and professors, except in this one area. And do you know what that is, Ken?
I don't know, ice cream tasting?
Yeah, I'm a super taster. And basically what that means is I've got more taste buds, those are, you know, fungiform papillae in the biz, than your typical eater. And mine are just particularly attuned to that category of food that we sometimes clinically describe as frozen novelties. So if we found ourselves at the dairy bar, I'd almost invariably be asked by my colleagues what I'd recommend. And Ken, I hate to seem immodest here, and we don't need to belabor this, but one thing led to another, and I was eventually asked by Jonathan the Husky himself if I'd consider enrolling in the UConn Ice Cream Sommelier School. And I've done most of this work under a nom de glace, but I'm one of about 85 master ice cream sommeliers in North America. And I have to say, it's been pretty rewarding to give back to the frozen novelty community. And so, I mean, a real highlight was when we were working to get frozen treats recognized by the James Beard Award category, and we didn't quite get it over the line, but the folks you meet, the clouds, the glaciers, the people working more on the Sunday side of the craft, it's just astonishing, the passion, the talent, people who really want to give back to the dessert world. And these are also the kind of people who know if you should put that hazelnut mucha latte, that's coffee ice cream, hazelnut fudge swirls, and chunks of dark chocolate, in a dish, or if you're going to get a better nose on that flavor with just a lightly tapered waffle cone. So this is the kind of level we're at here. And Ken, if there's one thing that I know about our listeners, it's that they also have the highest taste. And that's why I'm comfortable offering this ice cream sommelier experience to the lucky listener who writes in with the new name for this podcast. And here's how this is going to work. We're going to start off with just a couple of clinical tests. We're going to get an ear, nose, and throat doctor in to check on the raw count of taste buds in the crucial areas of the listener's tongue. And then we
seems a little bit invasive.
Well, I mean, but you really have to start with your baselines, Ken, or else your ability to do this is just going to be all out of whack. You've got to calibrate the equipment, you know?
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, I mean, I even have parts of my tongue insured, but we don't need to talk about that right now. And then we follow up with a simple taste for propylthiouracil, which just helps to establish whether or not you're a super taster. And look, you don't actually have to be a super taster to make this work, but we do want to set some baselines and just get a sense of some of the challenges we may need to address, you know, some of the weaknesses that we may need to think about during this course. And then, Ken, well, it's time to start learning frozen novelties. It's going to be a year-long apprenticeship, so we start in the classroom by nailing down the basics. We deal with sorbets, and those, of course, go back as far as 550 BC in Persia. We need to consider butterfat ratios and hard serve versus soft serve, cake versus sugar cones. And then once we've covered some of that, we can move on to the merits of your basic toppings. You know, chocolate sprinkles, rainbow sprinkles, the implications of each, the indications of when to use those. And eventually we'll have worked our way all the way up to sundaes. And so we just kind of climb the ladder to make sure the listener knows their way around the taste palette of whipped cream and the various kinds of cherries and so on. And so we, and well, when I say we, I really mean the me and the other ice cream sommeliers, we also think it's important that you get a sense of local flavors that help to make a region so distinctive. So we're the terroir, if you will, of an ice cream.
And exactly.
So we're going to make sure you know your way around a grape nut in Aroostook County, a baklava at the Puritan in New Hampshire, tiger tail in the Canadian Rockies, frozen pudding also in New Hampshire. You get the idea, Ken. Life is short, but the art is long. And at the early stage, we just want to make sure that the apprentice is expanding his palate or her palate. But anyway, once we've knocked off the technical side of things, we get to work on craft. We'll visit some of the premier North American producers to develop that cow-to-cone perspective that's just so essential for really getting a sense of premier frozen novelty manufacturer. So we'll learn about cattle selection, milk transport, churning, storage, everything that happens to make great ice cream. And of course, for the prospective ice cream sommelier, this gives an opportunity to get a better sense of the business side of ice cream, getting beyond cold hard serve to cold hard cash. And that's not all, Ken. After this, we want to put those skills to the test, so we'll be crisscrossing the Grand Estate on the New Hampshire Ice Cream Trail. That's right, Ken, 42 scoops in 42 days. From Hayward's to Moose Alley Cones, from Stewart's to John Sugar's House, to Licky to Chewy's. And this stage is really crucial to building up the apprentice's experience. They're applying what they've learned to a range of different ice cream styles and approaches. It really, Ken, it's crucial that a classically trained ice cream sommelier is familiar with ice cream of all different kinds, and this is also going to be an opportunity for the apprentice to get a sense of the ranges of possible presentation. And after that, Ken, the lucky listener is ready to sit the certified ice cream sommelier examination, and I'll rest assured that after this rigorous training, they'll be all set for the exam. I think, Ken, we can both agree as educators that the journey is as important as the outcome, but it's still good to pass the test, so it's a special bonus offer to the lucky listener. I'm going to throw in my complex packet of study materials. That's flashcards, access to my ice cream EndNote library, manufacturing diagrams, and, of course, the limited access to my tasting notes, the whole collection. So, Ken, if the listener wants to get on this sweet, sweet road to success, where would they send their winning new name for this podcast on this hot day?
That is quite a package. They would send that to newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. That's New Brunswick Archaeology spelled all one word, archaeology spelled ARCHAEOLOGY, newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com.
That's right, Ken. And if you look at that mailbox, we actually pre-recorded one of these yesterday, so we may not have very much in it. But what's new in our mailbox?
So there's not a whole lot new in the mailbox, but one of the things that I had not looked at yesterday that I thought might be something to highlight for the listener as we roll into the summer and approach our sort of our short hiatus that will transition us between season two and season three is more a thanking. A thank you to the listener for their continued support of the New Brunswick Archaeology podcast. I've noticed that we have upped our subscriptions on YouTube to 23 people now, which is actually up substantially from what it used to be.
That's very good for a platform we don't use.
Well, we do use it. And unfortunately, the YouTube listeners are not actually getting the full catalog NPR pods, because any of the episodes that are over 2 hours long actually don't get posted to YouTube because apparently they don't allow that. So I'm not entirely sure how to do that, but we will endeavor to do that. But the other thing that we wanted to draw attention to is the fact that we've crested 7,500 listens on our RSS, which is our host site. And I'm just pulling up some analytics here from Apple Podcasts, which actually our largest subscription service. And actually on Apple Podcasts, they indicate that we've crested 8,000.
Oh, listens. Wow.
And so what we wanted the listener to realize is that at some time in, we think probably calendar year 2024, we will have a 10,000th listener contest.
Oh.
That we had discussed. We are going to crest 10,000 listens, I think, sometime probably by the end of 2024, maybe late 2024. Mm-hmm. But it is entirely now within shooting distance. And I think that one of these prizes will not just go to somebody who names the New Brunswick Archaeology podcast, but to somebody who listens as we crest over 10,000. We have absolutely no way to identify who you are, but what will maybe pose to the listener. We will announce when we have hit 10,000 listeners.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can send us a screenshot of you listening to the episode that pushes us over the limit, we'll enter you an exclusive draw for some NBR pod swag that we'll maybe work on pulling together over the next couple months.
I mean, I think a screenshot or even maybe like a selfie if they listen in the work truck.
Oh yeah, that would be great. Yeah.
You know, or if they listen at the bar or while they're on the Peloton or yeah, whatever it is they do.
Or as I did on the weekend, not listening to us, but I've discovered. So
this is
I don't
how
like
we actually
running,
drive the numbers.
I don't really like running, but I've discovered that I like trail running.
Yeah.
And so I actually did my first competitive trail run on Saturday. I was part of a relay team.
Good for you.
That participated in the Cooley Cactus Crawl.
Oh, right.
I got a really nice t-shirt for it.
Nice.
I enjoy listening to podcasts while running because it distracts me enough from the fact that I don't enjoy running. But it's also, you know, like the trails all through the Cooley are quite pretty. So,
that's great.
I've got a visual distraction and an audio distraction. And so those of you who are maybe also out for a run listening to the podcast, and probably a very long run if you're hoping to get a whole episode in. So,
yeah, that's true. We really are, I had a friend in West Virginia who liked to run 50Ks, and whenever he mentioned this, I always said that sounded more like a salary than a distance. That
yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, if he's into 50Ks, that would be the equivalent of what, like four episodes?
Absolutely, you can get in a good chunk.
So for those of you looking that have actually recently joined us, maybe after reading the SAA archaeological record paper, if you are also an endurance runner what they call it, ultra marathon runner.
Yes.
We have a back catalog of, I think we've probably crested at least 100 hours of content. Would that
easily
be fair?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah.
And it would be a wonderful pairing, with your excruciating journey through that ultra marathon.
And if you want, actually, you know, I think if you're the 10,000th listener and you send us in a picture of you listening, being the 10,000th listener while you're on an ultra marathon, I think Ken and I would actually be happy to tune in live and even walk you through, you know, 20 or 30 minutes of your next ultra marathon.
Exactly.
We'll be the noise in your earpiece.
Yeah, I've lost my page here for a second, but so one of the other things that's kind of interesting about the stats and is that overall our our most listened to city is Fredericton, which makes sense. It's the capital of New Brunswick. And New Brunswick in general is the largest region. But on Apple podcasts, Toronto has actually superseded. So our top five cities for listeners on Apple podcasts are Toronto, Fredericton, Halifax, Montreal, and St. John, which is kind of cool.
That is. We should consider doing an on location at one of those cities.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the other thing, too, is I think we'll, you know, we're season three, we'll be back with probably another live podcast somewhere. And actually, and can you guess which the largest American city is?
That's an interesting question. Orono.
New York.
Really?
Yeah. Does your brother live there? Is it possible that what we're seeing is Toby in the stats?
I actually don't think Toby's a listener. As far as I know, he should be. I was going to drive the stats, but no, he lives in Boston now.
Cambridge. Oh, okay. So rounding out the top 10, Toronto, Fredericton, Halifax, Montreal, St. John, New York City, Moncton, Calgary, Vancouver, Ottawa, and Boston. And okay. Worcester. I'm guessing that's in
Worcester.
Massachusetts. Worcester.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Worcestershire's the sauce.
That's true.
If they'd like to sponsor this podcast.
And Lethbridge is right behind Worcester. So,
yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of cool.
That's
and that's just, we get a lot more detail in the Apple podcast stats than we do from our RSS hosting. But and in there, the top countries and listeners are Fredericton, United States, not applicable for the city, as there's no detail. And then St. John, Canada, not applicable. And then Montreal. So, right.
Well, East of the Rockies is certainly on the air.
East of the Rockies is on the air, yeah. And somewhere in Boardman, United States is also a high listener on RSS.
What state is that in?
I don't know. It just says Boardman.
Huh, I'm not sure. Well, if you're listening and you're in Boardman, shoot us an email.
Yeah, yeah, and thank you for listening.
Yeah, thank you for listening.
But yeah, so not a huge mailbag, but I thought I would update the listener that they're taking part in something that we're you know very proud of, and that it's pretty exciting, and that we're approaching what is kind of a really cool milestone, and we want to thank you for being part of that, and so we're getting our plans together for what the 10,000th listener is going to look like.
I mean, we've actually already crossed. We're at 10,000 imperial listeners. It's just that we're at 8,000 metric listeners.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So, we haven't converted yet.
Yes. All right. And so, Ken, we've got a very exciting program coming up. We're going to be talking to Emma Yasui in a far-reaching conversation, really spanning from diversity in archaeology all the way up to video games. And so,
yeah,
I guess without further ado, I'll introduce you about to introduce Emma.
Yeah. And listener, you might also learn, as Gabe did today, what Discord is.
That's so true. Yes. All right, Ken, you stay warm, I'll stay cool, and we'll see you in about 5 seconds to record the aftermath of the next segment.
Excellent. Enjoy, listener. All right, and so we are joined today on the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast by Dr. Emma Yasui, who is a research associate with U of T's Archaeology Center and a sessional instructor at York University. She is also a freelance cultural consultant and sensitivity reader for gaming products and a production team member on the Asians Represent podcast group. Emma got her PhD in 2022 from University of Toronto, and that's where Emma and I met, and her MSc from U of T in 2011. She also got an honors BSc from Lakehead University in 2009. Her research focuses on Hokkaido archaeological sites and Jomon period archaeology in Japan, with research interests including ancient food and diet, East Asian prehistory, stone tool technologies, cultural heritage, and the intersections between pop culture and archaeology. She has also contributed to projects in Jordan and China. And Dr. Yasui's research has appeared in the Journal of Archaeological Science Reports, Paleo-Orient, and Currents in Teaching and Learning, and as mentioned, as before, on the podcasts Asians Represent and former podcast or a previous contributor to Digging the Other Side podcast. So welcome to the show, Emma. Thank you for coming on.
Welcome to the show, Emma.
Thank you. Woo!
it's nice to see you again. And I think we last saw you at the CAAs in Saskatoon. We thought we should have this conversation.
And then I lost my voice.
Oh, that's right. I'd forgotten.
And so couldn't record anything.
That's right. It's all the screaming at the CAAs can do this. That's not everyone knows about the CAA mosh pit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Or just the loud bars where you're arguing about something at like 2 o'clock in the morning, and then you wake up the next day and it's just, you're done.
Yeah.
Done. Yeah.
And that's on Thursday and you've still.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Emma, so this year at the CAAs, you took part in the Black and Racialized Archaeology Network meeting. And so our listeners have heard some about this. We talked to Tommy Ng and Alvina Tan for an earlier program. But we wondered if you could just tell us a bit about the goals of that group and why you think it's so important for Canadian archaeology.
Of course, yeah. I'll probably say some very similar things to what people said before. But a general goal at this point is, you know, expansion ultimately is the goal. Maybe get something a little more official. But right now it's just about finding people who have felt like they don't have similar people in the field with them, or have faced issues with being one of the only racialized people within a department, on a site, in a project, and some of the complications and concerns that come along with that. So right now we're just trying to create a communication network, something where people can easily join and just start talking to people who have had similar experiences. And so the networking at the CAAs was not just about meeting people, but also trying to build a framework of goals and perhaps things that we can do once a more official collective is formed. And also, you know, trying to align on what we need or want to see out of Canadian archaeology as a nationwide discipline.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's sort of a shocking statistic in, there's a paper that Lisa Hodgetts and another group produced in 2020 that was sort of looking at the demographics of Canadian archaeology, and they quote, it looks to be a very white discipline, and that Asian and Black Canadians are substantially underrepresented compared to the percentage of the Canadian population. So 2.7% of 551 respondents versus 14.9% in the 2016 census data. So essentially, there are a lot more people who are Asian Canadians and Black Canadians than there are in archaeology, but you guys are coming together as a group, and do you get a sense that some of this is improving, that archaeology is maybe doing a better job of improving representation, or is a group like yours going to be really critical for building that kind of critical mass?
I think the group is essential, and while I would say there's a lot more effort and awareness of the experiences of marginalized and racialized people in general across society, there are also papers about the historic conscientism. Like, people are just more aware of how bad things have been. Social media helps with that. But within something like a discipline, especially one that is divided between academia, so like various universities, colleges, but also professional like CRM, there's no standard body or source of information to go to about what people have experienced, what other people's policies are like, how to do things better. And so most institutions are in some way trying to do better, but they don't necessarily know how. And a lot of the times that it gets boiled down to more labor, free labor, for the people who are experiencing the issues in the first place. So something that we talked about is how to offload emotional and free labor that's being placed on individual people of color and marginalized folks onto something like more of an organization or an office that can handle issues. But, oh boy, that's a big plan. I don't know at what point we'll be able to say that we have something like that. But for now, it's about putting people in contact so that at least you don't feel alone, or you don't feel gaslit. Like, you understand that this has happened before, how other people may have handled it, or how to talk to someone within your organization when something might be happening. And generally, they're unaware of that they're doing these things. So how to bring it up in a productive way.
For sure.
So it's tackling like practical stuff. Like, Tommy brought up kind of an interesting thing where, like, he said there's sort of this, you know, there's like a practical thing in CRM where if you don't understand sort of Asian Canadian history, you might miss out on like particular artifact classes or be able to like kind of like understand that sort of stuff. But I'm guessing from what you're saying too, there's also sort of a whole suite of issues pertaining to, like, you know, microaggressions or racism, or, you know, just like things that I think that, you guys are, the folks are probably experiencing in the field and that we're not really aware of, or are trying to find out, like, it's not just me that's experiencing this. There are other people who've had this experience. This is how they dealt with it.
Yep.
Okay.
Absolutely. And I come from the academic side, so I have no CRM experience, and we're finding too that academic position, while we all face similar things within archaeology, there are some different things that being a professor has, like how to handle the power dynamic within a classroom, especially if some of those students are also marginalized, racialized, and how to deal with a department who thinks they're doing great or wants to do better, but they don't know how, so they put it on the young, more precarious DOC scholars that are being brought in, things like that. And we've written all of this up. We have a paper coming out. I don't know if Tommy mentioned this. It will be in the Canadian Journal of Archaeology.
Excellent.
So look for that someday soon.
We will.
It is from a collection of authors, including Tommy and Nihal Gupta. So yeah.
Excellent. And when that comes out, we will try to make sure to put that in the show notes for a subsequent episode once that's available.
Yeah.
And so that'll be very exciting. And you also presented a paper at the CAA this past spring yourself, engaging Black and racialized descended communities with archaeology and heritage project. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. I stood in front of the room and said, this is something I would really love to do, but I'm not yet started. Which
this is one of those CA papers designed to cause yourself guilt in the future. Is that what this is?
Or just to see if there's any response, if anyone's just like, oh, that's a good idea, or like, I'd be interested, or like, that's a bad idea, you'll never do that. Which you don't tend to get. But yeah, so this was really me talking about my background as someone who has worked on ancient Japanese, Northern Japanese stuff, but is of Japanese-Canadian heritage. So my family was pre-World War II Japanese settled in BC that were then imprisoned and, you know, very much pressured to then move away from BC after the camps were closed. And so in my adult life, you know, starting as a teenager, I was trying to reconnect with some of that history and that part of my family. And I've just been realizing more and more that archaeology could really help with some of that personal interest. But also, there's a growing need and also interest in diaspora archaeology, or looking at these different groups who are now in North America in particular for what I'm interested in. So yeah, my presentation was about taking my background in the archaeology of food and specifically economic plants and trying to do some stuff with that in the Canadian Nikkei or the Canadian Japanese situation. Okay. And what I really focused on was that there are several species of plants that have been used since the period that I worked on, so the Jomon period, so 16,000 to 2,000 years ago across Japan. There are species of plants that those people were using that were then brought to Canada by early settlers and planted at various Japanese-Canadian villages, but also the imprisonment camps. And how we can use maybe even just survey identification of those plants as a way to indicate Japanese-Canadian presence.
Great.
Where very cool. Settlements and structures no longer survive.
So you take an interesting pathway that is called paleoethnobotanical research.
Yes.
Which is, you're looking at ancient plants in the archaeological record and what the stories they can tell us. And so can you tell us, maybe step back a bit and tell us a little bit about paleoethnobotany, what are the techniques that you use? And so you talked about survey, so actually looking to see if the plants are growing those locations. But if, for example, you find a site and maybe you're excavating, what are some of the things that you would do to look at the plant remains in that site?
Ken, can I just interrupt for 1 second and just note that I've noticed, I have an observation now, which is that 100% of the paleoethnobotanists to appear on this podcast have also been interested in gaming.
Oh.
And so I think this is a real pattern.
You know, food and games go together,
this
right?
This just dawned on me. But the, yeah. Go ahead, Emma. I'm sorry.
That's funny. Yeah, paleoethnobotany is a really broad category, just in general, the relationships between humans and plants throughout time. The ethno part means they're really interested in the cultural, sociocultural aspect. Like, it's not just archaeobotany, where you're looking at the species and if they're there or maybe even their natural range, but it's really about how people use them, what meanings they might have had. And so what I do specifically is known as ancient starch research, which just means I spend a lot of time at a microscope. I take residues and sediments off of artifact surfaces, put them on slides, and look at them under high magnification and identify the little starch grains that go into making starchy plants like potatoes and yams, beans, different grains like wheat. And yeah, we can use those little diagnostic art, like bits of plants, to kind of identify broader families of plants that may have been used for food, crafts, medicine. And yeah. When associated with artifacts in particular, it gives us a lot of information about what activities might have been done.
Cool. And you're doing this during the Jaman, or you've done a lot of this during the Jaman period.
Yeah.
Could you just catch both me and our listeners up on this? Am I right that sort of roughly this is kind of the Japanese Neolithic? Like, is that a kind of analogy?
It was called that a lot. There's a lot of ongoing debate about how to classify this period, and then also a debate about whether we should or be classifying this period. But yeah, the Jomon is, like I said, a very long cultural period between about 16,000 to nearly 2,000 years ago. It was found all across what is now Japan, so a lot of the main islands and little ones. And yeah, just about anything you can think of that was done in the past, pre-metallurgy, essentially was happening in somewhere in Japan at that time. So
it sounds hard to study.
Yeah, we have a lot of regional and temporal variation, but then the economy itself, like hunting, fishing, gathering, early cultivation and animal management, these are all parts of the basic economy happening throughout this period. And then, of course, the reliance on pottery and stone tools. So what marks the end of the Jomon is the introduction of metals, major shifts in the pottery style, and definite presence from the Korean Peninsula, and the introduction of rice agriculture. So it's essentially everything from Stone Age, so everything with pottery up until like metals and rice appear.
That's neat. And so in many ways, your work here in North America is kind of tracking that as just a massive continuity, even as part of a diaspora.
In a way, it's more just, I think it's interesting. That's something I chose to dedicate my career to. Also ends up overlapping with my personal history.
Cool.
Yeah.
But
so
yeah.
What are, And so the paper at the CAA was kind of like positing that this is a like an approach that you could take. What are the kinds of like plants that you would expect to see in some of these like Japanese Canadian contexts?
Yeah. So the big one that has already been talked about, there are articles about it, is known as fuki. It is also known as Japanese butterbur. It's eaten usually in the spring, but you can eat all parts of it. It's not that different looking from rhubarb in a lot of ways, but it is specifically a Japanese plant that was brought here by the Nikkei communities. And we know in places like Tashmi, some of the imprisonment camps, that there's butterbur growing all around because it was specifically brought in by the Nikkei people who were being held there. And we have little records and diaries about how this was done, how sympathetic neighbors would sneak in clippings of plants and seeds and things to the imprisoned people. So those are a great indicator and can be found all across, not just like the coast of Canada, but even down into the US for similar reasons. There are also things like Yamaimo, which is a Japanese mountain yam that is very distinctive and grows quite well on its own. And the forests across BC look very similar to the forests across parts of Japan, so it's not surprising that they can thrive in situations like this and are a staple food, very sought after. So we have a couple of plants. There are some others. I don't know how many you want me to talk about, but
no, that's good though. Yeah. That's,
and we may get you to send us some references too that we can drop in the show notes, just so if our sure, yeah, listeners are interested in learning more about these, we'll add those too.
Yeah. Yeah,
we might have some foodies on the show too that are interested in taking on some different cooking materials.
So, yeah, absolutely. And there's a really good book about Japanese Canadian kitchen gardens that was really helpful to me.
Oh, cool!
Oh, excellent.
That okay. I'll send you the info for, and you can make a link to it because it's also part of a community project in Vancouver to support the aging Japanese Canadian community.
Oh, awesome. Okay. Yeah, we'd love to put that in the show notes. And
yeah, definitely. It's called the Tonari Gumi, if you just want me to say it out loud, but awesome. Really cool organization. Yeah.
Very cool.
All right. Tonari Gumi. And so you're also a seasoned podcaster. The listener will notice that Emma sounds better than Ken and I do. And that's
and her microphone glows.
It is more polished.
It does. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
It is more confident. Ken and I, we're twitching nervously. Emma's perfectly confident here in front of the microphone.
And Emma's navigating, it's what, like 38 degrees there in Toronto right now?
It's pretty hot here right now. I am sitting still, but sweating profusely.
Me too, but it's perfectly comfortable where I am. That's the...
And I'm cold. It's not warm in Alberta right now.
Yeah. So, oh, wow. Yeah. Got a range here.
We wondered if you could tell us a little bit about your two podcasts, one, Asians Represent, and the other, which I understand is on a bit of a hiatus, Digging to the Other Side.
Yep. So I'll start with Digging to the Other Side because, I guess, segue. This has been on hold, not officially shut down, but yeah, we're all just taking a pause. And its focus was on people who identify as Asian, who also happen to be archaeologists, who are interested in Asian diaspora archaeology. And so we were bringing in people who are working on projects or in archives or just interested in these things and sitting down and talking about it. And then Asians Represent is very much ongoing and something I've been involved in heavily as both a team member, but also a Discord moderator, which is something I never thought I would be. And we are very much focused on Asian representation in pop culture and media, specifically within games. So a lot of our content is around tabletop RPGs or role-playing games like D&D and Pathfinder, as well as a variety of independent games. There's so much out there. And we look at how Asian cultures are essentially used or used as inspiration and brought into these different products by mostly people who do not identify with the culture that they are drawing from. And this has led to a lot of, you know, freely available work. If you are interested in franchises like Legend of the Five Rings, we did a 40-hour free series where we read through the core book and pointed out from our variety of backgrounds things that we noticed within this book about misrepresentation, harmful language, but also places where they may have done well. And yeah, talk to a variety of people who have worked with the franchise, but also been fans of it for a long time. So that's...
And so is that a book series or it's a series of games, like tabletop games?
Legend of the Five Rings?
Yeah.
Oh boy. It started out as a card game, but then it's also an RPG. Card game no longer exists, but the RPG is now owned by a new company and going through a complete revival and facelift, which I also worked on as a consultant. So it's a substantial series of products.
Basically.
There's also novels, light novels, and different things that have been made for it. So it's a big deal. It is a franchise. Yeah,
an RPG would be something like EverQuest or like an online game in which you are a character, or is it a real like? I feel like I'm revealing a bunch of naivete.
Yeah. So okay. RPGs, yes, role playing. Yeah. You tend to pick up being a character within a wider world. Yeah. But TTRPGs or tabletop are usually paper or now like digital interface based. You create a character with set abilities and equipments, and you play through stories usually led by a game master who has set out a story and some challenges for you. Okay. So it's a lot of imagination.
So you have +2 relaxation with the shirt you're wearing right now.
Oh yeah. It was interesting the way
Roll for initiative. Yeah.
That's great because the way Emma was describing it sounded like comprehensive exams. So I was confused about it. But a Discord server, just so we're catching up me and the listener here. What is a Discord server?
Do you know what Discord is?
I know what Discord is. Yeah, I'm actually on a couple of Discord channels.
Yeah.
So. Oh wow.
It's just another like social interaction platform, but it was largely developed for games and gaming, and they're based usually around servers or communities. And Asians Represent has a fairly large and active Discord where fans of the show, or people who are interested in games or the things that we would talk about can just join and chat. It's almost like the upgraded version of forums.
Oh, neat.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was just going to say, it's like the new version of like an internet forum. Like,
great.
Yeah.
You know, like I used to be part of a Subaru Forester forum.
Oh my God, Ken.
and I'm guessing that they probably have a Discord now.
Well, that was good, Ken. I felt like the least cool person on this podcast when I asked what Discord was. And now that I found out you were on Subaru Forester Discord, I feel much cooler again. So.
There's Discords for all sorts of things.
Yeah. But Emma, can you tell us a little bit about your consulting work and what you do with that hat?
Yeah, because that was born directly from me joining the Asians Represent team initially during the pandemic. There's a lot of interest in content, just streaming on Twitch and making videos. And so I ended up on that Legend of the Five Rings read through. And after that, I started getting asked to review people's products officially for money and not just on Twitch or on YouTube. So what I do is, since I specialize in both Japanese diaspora as lived experience, but also in terms of anthropology, because I am an academic, my background in media studies, as well as my understanding of Japanese history since essentially the beginning of time in Japan, I use that to look at Japanese inspired and based on Japanese society, culture, history, mythology, anything like that, games that have drawn from these sources, but are not being, you know, made by someone who identifies it anyway as Japanese. So I read through to make sure that, one, it's not racist. Two, it doesn't sort of perpetuate harmful stereotypes or language. And then also, depending on what they're doing, I check for things like accuracy or also tone, vibes. If they're going for a particular time period in Japan, then I help give them the things that, you know, make it seem correct, but also still playable and fun.
Do you get is it always kind of like when you give the feedback, is it always sort of positively received, or is it kind of like, well, no, that we don't want that character to be like that now? Like, you know,
yeah.
Like, are people excited to kind of have like more accuracy in a game? Is it received well that way?
Yeah. So anyone who's reaching out, because consulting isn't necessarily a standard part of making a game product, it's becoming more common, but it's still not standard. A lot of people haven't done it before. So a lot of people who are reaching out just want to do better and be good people and make a product that will appeal to as many members of an audience as possible. So they're generally coming into it ready to be told that something's not okay and to change it. there's only been a few times where there might be a bit of a back and forth about like creative intention versus what I'm saying. But for the most part, I put a lot of explanation into why something should change or why it might be a problem. And so overall, I'd say very positive response to this kind of work. And that's also great. Oh boy, was I not expecting just how much these products would need. Some of this.
Well, so what I'm thinking about right now is that you're pitching essentially to the listener that like your archaeology degree can take you to incredibly interesting places,
and absolutely.
Transcends like the application of anthropology in different ways is really cool. Being able to bring that into board games.
We at Agents Represent have talked about archaeology in particular, because some of the other production team members are also archaeologists or ex-archaeologists, and there's a lot of overlap between archaeology and games. And we like to talk about how archaeology is essentially world building. Creating these societies as well as daily activities. Whether we talk about individuals or not, we are kind of creating characters that people the worlds that occupy the past, right? So we have a type of understanding of how societies throughout time have worked or not worked, and what is likely to happen within a human society or what's realistic or expected. And so when we look at fantasy worlds, we have sort of a framework for how the world works that we can then look at any kind of made up or even based on real world society and be like, oh, that's not how people do things. Or I see what you're going for, but here's some information or things to consider, you know?
Yeah.
So archaeology has some broad applications.
I like that a lot. It's sort of the way in which archaeology helps you not just to conceive of a whole bunch of different ways of the past, but of potential futures too, I think.
It's kind of a really neat.
And it's good to know that there's a room full of paleoethnobotanists that are on this very problem for the gaming community.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So are you gonna dovetail this beyond games? Like, is this gonna become like you're like working for video game companies or production studios? You know, like I think about like Shogun becoming like, you know, huge production right now. Like, are there opportunities that extend beyond TTRPGs?
Well, I think there are, but whether or not I would ever be asked to do the things is an unknown. So I've been doing consultation now for over two years, and I've worked on mostly games. I've also written a bit, and board games. I worked on a character generator, so costume consultation, and yeah. I would love to do other stuff, but it's just a matter of someone knowing about me and, you know, asking me to do these things.
Yeah, I think the big victory will be when you're able to kind of like merge your Jomon research into one of these TTRPGs, right?
I already did. So I was one of the authors on Pathfinder's most recent world book for Tianxia, which is their fantasy Asia setting. And I wrote the fantasy Japan. And part of it was very much based on Jomon period stuff.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
That's great.
Is it Brian Fagan that has done some of those kind of historical fictions where he's brought in archaeology and written them into like kind of novel form? Am I getting that wrong?
Almost I don't know.
Likely. I know also Peter Bleed did that kind of for, he wrote a book about like a samurai sword in Japan, but it was sort of a mystery / fantasy book. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
That's awesome.
Well, this is, I admit, I did not realize this conversation was going to be this far ranging, but that's very exciting. This is all, I feel like we should do another episode on this very topic. We should somehow get the group from the gaming paleoethnobotany community on here for a round table on the topic.
But we can start a Discord channel on it, Gabe.
Absolutely. I can't wait. I've always wanted to moderate a Discord channel. Ken used to be just the king over at Reddit / Subaru Forester, but now
he
really expands his.
I am actually in the like a Subaru subreddit on that's a
I'm not surprised.
So Emma, we're mindful of your time, especially in the sweltering heat that is Ontario right now. And we just wondered if sort of before we let you go, if you had any sort of closing thoughts about questions of representation in archaeology, or where, say, maybe a student who's listening to this and is interested in these topics could explore for further information, or just sort of some closing thoughts in that area.
Yeah, well, the big takeaway from the CAAs and working with this group has just been that none of us are actually alone. And anything that one person is experiencing, someone else has. And there's a lot of value in just talking about it. We're hoping to create a more accessible way for people to join the conversation. So perhaps a Discord server or something where we can just throw out an invite. You can come in, and if you ever have something you want to talk about or a problem, just drop it in a space like a Discord server. But,
sounds awesome.
A lot of work to be done. We're still figuring it out, processing the CAAs and finishing that paper.
Yep.
Awesome.
That's great. Well, and when that Discord server is up, or when those, you know, resources are available, we're happy to promote all that stuff, because I think that
amazing.
That's a fantastic pathway.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, we really appreciate you coming on, Emma, and this was a fantastic conversation, and I learned a lot, and also it was good to, and we'll get some of these resources from you to share in the show notes.
Yeah,
for sure.
And I'm gonna be bugging my friend who's a big board gamer to see if he has any of the Legend of the Five Rings games, because I'm very curious about these now.
Oh yeah, well, I could always, run a game or do something like that.
Yeah, here I was thinking we were gonna have the first ever New Brunswick archaeology podcast LAN party, but then I discovered that this is the.
Oh, I would love to work on video games, but yeah, separate industry. I don't know how they do consultation.
Well, this could be maybe the crossover power of this podcast. Well, so if the video game designers out there are listening, we'll put Emma's contact info in the notes.
Yeah absolutely. And ask me about how Legend of Zelda uses archaeology, because I love talking about that.
Oh, there you go. So we should
season
get you
four.
On with Bill, actually,
yeah.
and have like an Archaeo Gamers discussion, because Bill does this stuff too, like Bill Farley.
Yeah, and runs a Discord server, or is part of it.
Okay.
There is an Archaeo Gaming Discord server.
All right.
There you go.
It's a small world on Discord.
Yeah.
Big world's game.
Big world. Sorry.
Big world.
And the world's constantly being generated is the other.
Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly. Well, Emma, thank you so much for joining us for this discussion.
Well, thank you so much, Emma.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, Ken. And I think now it's time for our hit pieces.
I think it is time for hit pieces.
Hit pieces here, and Ken, we're doing that thing where one of our hit pieces today is something we have read. The next thing is something we're planning to read, but looks very interesting.
I've started reading. Actually.
You started reading it. Oh, okay.
Yeah,
that's right, listener. Ken is on this problem. But our first one is by a friend of us, friend of the podcast, Catherine Patton at the University of Toronto, along with her colleagues C. Hernandez and K. Maxwell. And that's in the most recent SAA Archaeological Record. And that article is called A Decolonial Reflection on Archaeological Pedagogy and Practice. And what Catherine and her colleagues are writing about here is incorporating decolonization approaches, basically, even at the intro level, and engaging with settler colonialism. And I think this actually kind of fits with some stuff we've talked about before, Ken, about trying to build these important topics about kind of why we do archaeology and archaeology's articulation with society actually at all stages of the archaeology curriculum. I know these are discussions we're having at UNB. I'm sure the discussions you're having at Lethbridge. And they're clearly discussions that KP is sort of spearheading at Toronto. And so highly encourage the listener to check this out, especially if they're teaching archaeology at all. And this is, again, TSAR is open access, which is fantastic.
It is, yeah. And I wonder if you should get KP on the show to talk about pedagogy and how sort of reshaping archaeological curriculum in kind of in a modern way, and how different approaches, like something I've learned from, for example, my brother-in-law is a teacher. But he teaches young kids, and we're trying to teach my son, you know, like alphabet and reading and stuff like that. And we were getting kind of frustrated, and he was getting frustrated. And it's interesting to hear from like a person who's trained in how to teach that the way we were teaching was totally wrong, because this is the way that you would teach for like this age group, right?
Oh, interesting.
Like, there's a totally different way of doing that. And I think that at a university level, what's interesting is that we're, you know, we are faculty and we teach, but very few of us have actually ever had a formal education in how to teach, right? And so Catherine is somebody who actually has, learned how to apply these things as pedagogy, and how do we structure different teaching methods to get students to think critically about stuff. And and I think that would be I think that'd be a useful resource for folks. So.
Absolutely, yeah. No, and Catherine really is kind of leading the way on some of this work, which I guess I know is a big part of her job at U of T. We should also get her on to talk about her shellfish research at some point.
Yes. Shells and pedagogy.
Shells and pedagogy. Yeah, which we don't want to be shellfish with your time, so we might want to try to. Ken, then you could tell the one that you've read the intro to, and I've read the back of.
Yeah. So we want to highlight Thomas Peace's book that just it came out in 2023, called "The Slow Rush of Colonization: Spaces of Power in the Maritime Peninsula, 1680 to 1790." That's from UBC Press, and we were drawn attention to this because Gabe and I are both part of the Canadian Studies Network now, it was announced that Thomas has actually won the 2024 Canadian Historical Association's Clio Prize for excellent writing in the Atlantic region. And so this book is generally about sort of historical processes and relationships between Indigenous communities in the Maritimes and the colonial powers. And so I'm going to actually quote a small section that from the first chapter. And so I think this kind of gets at what the crux of the book is about. Though day-to-day life remained primarily defined by the Mi'kmaq, Wolastoqiyik, Pescotamacati, Penobscot, Kennebec, Pigwacket, Sokoki, Kawasuk, Missisquoi, Kayenkehaka, and Wyandot nations, these people's homelands were at the heart of France's and Britain's imperial desires. The social, political, cultural, and economic relationships that developed within these spaces required deft navigation between competing understandings of space and territory. And so the book is basically about how different political and social institutions, both at the colonial government level and among the indigenous nations in the Maritimes, on the Maritime Peninsula, basically, how they intersected with one another and how those different groups negotiated different spaces of power. And so how they were able to assert political authority or sovereignty, and also how different systems were put in place to try to kind of shape the political narrative. And so you have sort of what you see as a transition between a primarily indigenous governed space to one by 1790, where you have a really aggressive settler colonial government control, basically, that is very actively trying to disconnect those indigenous political entities. So I think it's going to be a really fascinating read. I've read the first chapter. I was very happy to find that our library has an ebook version of it. So I've got it on my tablet now for whenever I want to pick it up.
That's great. And am I right, Ken, that this book explicitly builds on Elizabeth Mankey, my late colleague at UNB, on her work involving a sort of political ethnohistory of the far Northeast?
Yeah. And so, and her concept of spaces of power, and okay. These are like, so that kind of theoretical framing.
Excellent. Well, that looks well worth reading. I'm looking forward to seeing if my library has a digital copy. And I have also ordered the paperback version from Amazon because it looks important. And congratulations, Dr. Beast, on winning the Clio Prize. It's
that's
a big deal.
Yeah, that's excellent. That's a big deal. So.
All right, Ken, so I think we have reached the bottom of this bottle of ice-cold Courvoisier, and I may take I may pour myself another one and find my way to the swimming pool.
Yeah, that's you've got a pool to go to. I've got a coffee to finish, and there is sunshine outside, so I may actually sit on the deck this afternoon and do a little bit of reading.
Oh, excellent! That sounds lovely. By the next episode, Ken might be all the way through the slow rush of colonization.
I might be.
Yeah. All right, Ken. Well,
and it might be warm enough to have a drink outside.
Yeah. Well, it's also, what time is it where you are, Ken?
It's 12:15 or 12:20.
Okay, yeah. So we've gotten you into the afternoon.
Yeah, exactly.
There we go.
We're in safe territory now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All right, listener. Well, thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you in about a fortnight.
And we'll talk to you later, listener. Thanks again, and let's onward and forward to 10K.
Absolutely, and remember, think about where you want to be, where you want to say you were when you were the 10,000th listener to the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast.
Exactly. All right. Bye, listener.
Bye, listener.